whenever you get to that point, whether it's a promotion, whether it's a bonus, yes, it feels good for a couple minutes. And you realize the fleeting nature of external achievement. And don't get me wrong, it's having more money is a very good thing. It makes life easier. But you know, and your listeners know, the marginal utility of an extra dollar flatlines at like 85K. And so it's not the billions and millions of dollars that really bring that shift in happiness.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Before we start, I just want to share two quick things with you. If you have a guest recommendations or stories that you think we should know about, shoot us an email at hello@unmistakablemedia.com. We love hearing from our listeners. And if you're looking for a keynote speaker for your event or want to bring our team at Unmistakable Creative to your event or organization for a workshop on creativity and productivity, visit unmistakablecreative.com/speaking, send us the details, and we'll be in touch. And as always, today's episode is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. Whether you're looking to start a new website or move an existing one, HostGator can help. They have 24/7 live support via phone chat and email, an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy, and if you want to move from an existing host to HostGator, they make it free and super simple. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Okay, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, so, you know, I actually came across your story by way of our former guest, Christine Lai, who said that you have been basically called Oprah for millennials. And I thought, okay, this is somebody I have to talk to because this just sounds absolutely fascinating. But before we get into your actual work, I want to start with a question that I have found has been very interesting and revealing. And that is, what did your parents do for a living? And how did that end up impacting the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
Wow. That is a really deep question that I've thought more about now than I've ever had in my life. I'm 37 and three quarters for context for your listeners. Mm-hmm. My parents. So the short answer is that my dad worked one job at the United Nations in New York City for 35 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was his first job after moving to the States in the early 70s. I was born in the late 70s. And yeah, different era. Put your head down, one job, and do it well. Don't think about the grass is greener and optimize for comfort, not risk. Mm-hmm. My mom was a teacher, was a teacher, and she took a break, probably 7 odd year break while my sister and I were growing up. But she was a French teacher for her entire career, save for that break. And so, and the reason why I think a lot about this recently is probably a little bit less related to, actually, I'll step back. One of the reasons why I think a lot about it is that I left a very kind of comfortable, predictable, well-known career track where I was having good success and actually didn't know what I was going to do next. And so for an immigrant family who basically came to the States with nothing but their degrees, no family, no savings, just a dream and a work ethic, it was a little bit, of a shock for them for me to do something so abrupt, and so that's one of the questions I always get from people. Is the first question I get is, "What are you doing about health insurance?" The second question I get, which is we should talk about that too. The second question I get is "What did your wife think?" And then the third question I get is, "What do your parents think?" Uh-huh. And I think about it a lot in terms of the way in which I grew up, which was middle class. It felt a little bit more kind of lower middle class in terms of not much focus on stuff. Very much a focus on experiences, but, you know, in the 80s, whether it was starter jackets or Air Jordans or Super NES, there wasn't much of that in our house. And you had to either save up for it, which on a $5 allowance, it would take years, or just not get it. And I think that I really honor and respect that upbringing and that frugality. But it does have a little bit of scarcity thinking behind it. And so when you fast forward, you know, 38-year-old guy worked in finance, the world's changed, the tools have changed. There is this need to kind of reconcile and reprogram some of these beliefs that you had growing up that mostly came from your family into your current personal circumstances, your professional circumstances, and the environment that we're living in.
Wow. Okay. So that actually raises a question. You know, you mentioned reconciling and reprogramming sort of the beliefs and mindsets of the environment that you were brought up in, which really was the question that I was actually headed towards. I mean, you know, having grown up with parents like this, especially a dad who worked at the same job for 30 years, I mean, my dad's a college professor, so I think we both have had a very similar sort of narrative. I'm curious, I mean, in your own life, how you've managed to unwind that narrative that you've been brought up with, especially when it's been so entrenched into your life. You know, over the course of your life, how have you managed to unwind it in your own life?
Yeah, it's really hard. And I think you probably culturally come from a similar respect where there's just similar background or mindset where there's such a strong emphasis on respect for elders, particularly your parents. And layer on one additional part of that is that I'm a pleaser by personality wise, and so it's been it really tugs at me, because the last thing that I ever want to do is be disrespectful to my parents, who gave everything to my sister and I, but. With age and with a lot of self-inquiry, I realized that a lot of these beliefs were holding me back, and so you get to a point where I hate to be so crude, but it's almost like a cost benefit analysis of what they were. And so I think one of the big things was always being respectful about it with my parents. And so one thing that really, and it's like it's like winning or convincing someone in an argument, someone who might disagree with you politically, is really speaking in a language that they can speak to. And so when I left my job, it wasn't, at first it was like risk and money and status to some extent. But then I reframed it, not because I was being sneaky, but I said, look at, I am being the father that I want to be. I am such a better father now because of flexibility and all the other stuff, versus when I was, you know, always on a BlackBerry and traveling and were responding to emails at, you know, Saturday nights. And when you put it in that common language, in with a value that they really understand and associate with, then it really kind of changed things for them. So it wasn't like I'm abandoning everything you taught me. No, far from it. It was actually I am doubling down on one of the key values you taught me, the importance of family, and while maybe shedding some of the other things that came with it. And then there's just the flat out reality where I wouldn't say, I mean, my parents are going to be listening to this, but sometimes you just like lie a little bit, where that, you know, $150, $200 pair of jeans, it was like $75 and call it a day.
Yeah, a tactic.
You know, some things won't change.
Yeah, a tactic I've used many a times. How much do those shoes cost you? About $100. It's like, why is there a receipt for $300 in the bag?
Exactly. And the biggest thing, and this is, I'm trying to have this conversation with them now, because now, I mean, we're all adults now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it does come down to communication. But the biggest thing that I'm trying to, that I want them to get, that I've learned about myself, that I actually, now I have things to teach them as well. And the biggest thing that I want to share with them of a part of this rewiring was this belief that to enjoy something, you must suffer.
Uh-huh.
And that is very much, I've seen it as kind of an immigrant way of thinking. And I just don't believe in that anymore. And especially with my parents now, who are getting older and they're in retirement. If anything, I'm sure you and I would agree that we don't really believe in the concept of retirement in the traditional sense, like snowbirds in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
But they are in their retirement in the sense that they don't have to work. And it's like, remove that element of suffering. Don't, you know, second triple guess yourself when you're indulging yourself. And it's not even Starbucks. It's just like non-deli coffee versus deli coffee. Because there you unlock joy and joy in the moment, you know. And that's where I think I can share, you know, learnings with them. And that's a beautiful thing when the kid realizes that he can share with his elders and his parents.
So, you know, I have a question about this. You know, my parents are familiar with my work. They've read, you know, my book. They don't listen to the podcast, but I'm curious how receptive your parents have been to this way of thinking. Because, I mean, I love my parents. I would not say that they're entirely receptive to the sort of message of go live a more meaningful life. And, you know, I always jokingly say, I think Indians believe in, you know, a deferred life plan because they believe in reincarnation. And I always say, you know what, if I get reincarnated as a cockroach, I think I'm going to, you know, gamble most of my life. I'm going to try to get as much as I can out of this life and not, you know, consider the second one.
Yeah. And so the question is how they...
How receptive have they been to your ideas and sort of, you know, getting them to change their minds about things?
Yeah, well, my dad will say, so when are you getting a job? I'm like, no, this is the job. and then my mom, you know, we still laugh a lot about blogging where she'll email me my typos.
Uh-huh.
And so it's like, no, it's not sentence. It's not like the newspaper. And so then I kind of at a joking level, I think that they're coming around. And the other thing is, once the Oprah for Millennials article came out, it's like, can we send this to all our family? Then it's like, then things are like a little bit better. Uh-huh. But in all seriousness, I think that they've gotten comfortable with the fact, as a finance or former reformed finance person, they're comfortable with the fact that I'm not going to make a financially irresponsible decision. So that's a big worry off of their mind. That would be one thing.
Yeah.
I think the thing that really makes, I think there's two things that make them uncomfortable. One that's smaller and the other that's bigger. So the smaller one is this concept, and you'll know exactly where I'm coming from with this, that you would do work for free. And so I think they didn't understand that, you know, I started this small email newsletter, which has grown into RadReads, and I would spend, you know, 2 to 7 hours a week on it. And they could not understand that there was no direct monetization for 7 units of time. Meanwhile, you and I know that you build that up and then abundance, right? All these things start to happen, things that you would never have imagined happen and things that you did imagine would happen. So that would be the first thing. And then the second one, and I think a lot of this is not limited to my parents, but the question is, why do you need to be so vulnerable so publicly? I think that's not just them. That's my whole Wall Street brethren.
Yeah.
Just wondering, like, why are you going there? You know, especially at the beginning where it was so new. Uh-huh. I had left all this change in my own life. And I think that you know, a lot of, now I'm just going to speak generationally, not even my parents per se, uh-huh, is just this belief that males in particular have to be, emotionally strong, indefatigable, know it all. They have every answer. They're never afraid. And I mean, you and I know that's bullshit. But I think that the older generation is like, what? I mean, even if it's bullshit, why would you like go around screaming on the top, on rooftops about it and calling attention to it?
Mm. Wow. So I'm curious. I mean, you mentioned being a father, and I am very, very curious about how this whole experience has changed your perspective on raising kids. And, you know, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's a loaded question because I don't have kids, but, you know, mm-hmm, I figure maybe all these interviews will arm me for the day that it actually happens.
Yeah. Well, nothing will arm you. But having kids, I guess I'm going to start with a very New York, maybe lesser San Diego issue, but it has to do with school, mm-hmm, and private school and the cost thereof, but also with, external validation and/slash judgment. And it's just something that we're going through right now, you know, because our daughter is the mature age of three. So you should be thinking about school. But I guess I really, the combination of stepping off of a very known track, really, I needed to do the work and develop the confidence to really stop caring about what other people thought. And by no means am I an expert in that. I think that's just life's journey, mm-hmm, that dates back to our caveman ancestry. But I think that what it cleared up for me specifically when it comes to parenting is only you know what's best for your kid. And I think that sounds very obvious. But when you live in a society / professional environment / coastal bubble where there are a lot of things that are just assumed about, and here I'm using education specifically, but everyone has advice about how things should be done with a child. And the first one that really kind of upset my wife and I when our child was born, we love to travel. They'd say, oh, well, you're not going to travel for another 6 years. And I'm like, really? Like, that's a bummer. And then a few hours or a few days later, I was like, no, we're going to travel. And we had, and we went on, we happened to go on, our daughter has been she's been on 4-month adventures across Southeast Asia with us. And so I think that you need to really have that conviction in kind of your own beliefs, your family beliefs, and your own values, to know that only you know what's right, and people are going to second guess, people are going to give you advice, and you should listen and be open to it. And so I think I kind of tie that in with the external validation part and the child part. So again, that's me answering with my immigrant child mindset of a very pragmatic piece. Huh. I think on the more emotional side of things, a switch flips and it's just not about you anymore. And someone who was very manic about career, who was very much kind of achievement driven, it's not that you lose the desire to do those things, but they really become less important. And I think it kind of, people talk about losing that edge a little bit in with aging in general. But I think kids, having a kid really makes a step function out of it. And overnight, the center of your world shifts away from you and your spouse or your marital unit to the child, like, I mean, biologically. And I think that that's beautiful. I think it usually hits people at a time when they're probably ready for some kind of internal shift. And at the same time, it's absolutely terrifying. and I lay that on now with a second coming. I'm like on the way. I'm like, oh my God, we barely can keep our head above water with a first. How are we going to do it with a second?
Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit. And I want to talk specifically about your career and kind of, you know, the trajectory of it and how it has led you to the work that you're doing today. So kind of walk me through that journey and some of the significant sort of transition points and inflection points in it.
Cool. Okay. So you got a little bit about my background. Born in New York City. I pretty much always lived in New York City. I think the one part that I want to, because it comes back to childhood, that your first question. I was kind of a nerdy Magic the Gathering, quasi hacker. I was so skinny. Everyone wanted to be my friend. I was the guy. It's like, oh, he's such a nice guy. We'd never date him because we wouldn't want to ruin the friendship. It was like the worst thing that you could be labeled as a high school male. Mm-hmm. And I say that because that story, with distance, it kind of, you see it resonate over and over again in my career. Went to Yale, studied computer science and minored in economics. Again, I was only going to study things that would bring me more income potential. And then left and started investment banking in 2001. And so I was in investment banking for a little under 2 years, and then in a much smaller part of the finance industry called fund of hedge funds, which is where you're a fund, but you invest in other hedge funds at two firms. And I did that for the combined was 14 years. The last 8 years, I was at BlackRock, big publicly traded financial services company, where I ran the New York research team. And so that's the finance chunk, but I'll walk you through a few of the different step functions. So I absolutely hated investment banking and ran away from that like the plague, where I realized that there was no way that I was going to work 110 hours a week with a completely unpredictable schedule. I then went into fund of funds, which was actually a nascent in 2003. I mean, hedge funds have been around for a long time, but the wave of hedge funds, this was like right around the Alan Greenspan era, was really starting to take off. It was really kind of the golden era of hedge funds. It feels a little bit like startups now, where you turn left, you turn right, every 25-year-old is on their third and it wears it as a badge of honor. And there's a little bit of there's a little bit of ego and humble bragging around it. But I caught that hedge fund wave as an investor kind of early in its life. And the cool thing about the hedge fund industry is it truly is some of the smartest people you've ever met that are running these hedge funds. And there's a lot of them. And my job was to go around, not at the beginning, but at the end, was to go around a little bit like a VC, is to find them, cultivate relationships with them, and then ultimately decide if you want to invest with them. And then I guess the difference with a startup is you have the ability to redeem. And so do you want to keep the investment? And it was so cool, such a cool world because of how quickly it was growing. But also it really required you to have a very, very broad knowledge. You would have to be able to talk to someone who invested in bonds, to talk to someone who invested in small cap stocks, and then someone that did, you know, quantitative algorithmic trading. And that was just a deeply, deeply intellectually rewarding intellectually rewarding experience, and you got to meet some phenomenal people. I did that at a small firm for my first 4 years, and then I moved to BlackRock, where I spent my last 8 years. And I think there were two things that really, I think, were my secret weapon, I guess, my competitive advantage in those early days, kind of in my 20s to mid-20s. And the first was I was a voracious learner, but in a way that was a little bit unhealthy, in the sense that I consumed white papers and textbooks and just like really boring stuff. And I would always, I kind of shaped my career around optimizing for promotions and financial reward. And so I think, you know, that's a good thing, but I think I did it so excessively, in the sense that I don't think I read fiction in my 20s, period. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I think I look back now as someone that almost, not only reads fiction, but I probably 50% of my reading is fiction. I'm like, man, what a waste. Yeah. I look back at college. I went to Yale, which has some of the best, you know, history of China, constitutional law, art history. And all I took were economics and computer science classes. And now I'm watching these classes on some MOOC. And I'm like, I went to that school. Like, why did I actually get the real thing? Yeah. But alas, you learn these things with age. So I think one thing was I was hyper focused on consuming information and consuming difficult information. And then the second thing, again, I guess there's three. The second thing, which is related to the first thing, is I had mastered every productivity hack out there, especially in the early 2000s, which was before blogs. Uh-huh. And so you had to A, create them yourself, or B, find them in, God forbid, books. And so I had lots of little hacks, and we could talk about that as well, potentially. And then the third thing was a heavy focus on relationships. Mm-hmm. And I think you had Adam Grant as a guest.
Definitely.
And you know, his book really crystallized it for me, because I knew I had an approach that people thought I was crazy, to just help people and not ask for anything in return. And especially in finance, they look at you like you have three heads. And it just never happens. No one goes up to someone else in finance and says, "Hey, I just want to be helpful. What could I do?" They're like, "You want something, and it's going to be pretty big or pretty bad." And so that was a thread that really kind of carried me throughout my career, and really expanded into some of the work that I'm doing now. So that was kind of the early part of the career. And I think BlackRock was a big kind of inflection point. It was kind of like the back half of my finance career. Uh-huh. But maybe I'll just stop there for a second, because I've been talking a lot.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, because your story parallels my friend AJ Leon's on so many levels. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but I'll have to tell you about him after we get done. You know, yes. He walked away from a high-profile investment banking job 4 days before his wedding. And out of all that, something that caught my attention that you said was that a good amount of everything you did was about optimizing for promotion or financial gain. Mm-hmm. And I am really curious, you know, what are the life lessons that you took away from approaching a career like that, like with that being such a driving force behind your career? And what would you want people to know about that?
Because
I'd imagine, as somebody who worked at a hedge fund, not only did you manage to do it effectively, but it worked really, you know, in your favor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to answer that with a story about The Rock.
Okay.
And so The Rock, I think last year was the highest paid entertainer in Hollywood. $45 million last year.
Okay.
And I just saw this little clip he did in some Asian GQ magazine. And it said, it was talking about his background, which I didn't know about, but he was very poor, homeless, and his way out of poverty was through wrestling via having developed this insane body, physique. And so for him, he always goes to the gym at 4 in the morning and just like goes berserk at the gym. And so he, in this little quote, he says, "So me going to the gym at 4 a.m. every morning is a way of telling myself that I will never be in poverty again." And I'm paraphrasing. And then he there's an ellipse and he goes, "I probably should talk to someone about this, but whatever." And I think that it really, you know, it's hard for me to preach about like, you know, preach or share about finding yourself, pursuing happiness. And people are like, "Oh, but you made all this money and you got the thing that people want." And so we don't have that. So we can't do those other things yet. And I think the reason why I brought up the story about The Rock is that whenever you get to that point, whether it's a promotion, whether it's a bonus, yes, it feels good for a couple minutes. And you realize the fleeting nature of external achievement. And don't get me wrong, it's having more money is a very good thing. It makes life easier. But you know, and your listeners know, the marginal utility of an extra dollar flatlines at like 85K. And so it's not the billions and millions of dollars that really bring that shift in happiness. I had to learn that. I had to experience that. I'm nowhere in that category of financial success. But I think the thing that I would share is I was lucky. I got promoted to managing director at 31 years old, which it's hard to tell, but the average age is probably in your late 30s, early 40s. Mm-hmm. And so I had a head start on that. And I got that and I was like, "Oh, okay, cool. Now what?" It feels nice and maybe I get a few extra meetings now because of my title. But to go back to The Rock, that emotional unsettledness, whether it's the racing mind, the inability to be present in front of loved ones, hell, I'll say it, like feeling like an imposter, those feelings don't go away. And so that kind of launched me into some of the work that I'm doing now. And that's the message that really, really gets me excited. And so I give you it in numerical terms because that's how I think. I think my life was, you know, I'm like The Rock. I don't look anything like The Rock, but I do overcompensate for some of the things I talked before with a lot of intense physical exercise. Uh-huh. And so my passion for physical fitness, let's say, is an 8 out of 10. I talked to you about not reading fiction for 10 years and reading white papers on vacations. My passion for consuming and developing skills, let's say, was 8 out of 10. My ability to emotionally self-regulate, what it looked like if you had a video camera inside of my head, was a 2 out of 10. And I wasn't unhappy, but I was just like, I think it's just the natural human angst. You know, the Buddhists call it the monkey mind, the comparing mind. You know, other people call it stress. Other people call it imposter syndrome. It's just, it's being human. You know, I think Naval Ravikant said it is like, with all this technology gains, our operating system is still 10,000 years old. And I think that was my realization that, you know, maybe my external, the features looked cool, but the OS was still really, really old school. And it needed tending to. And so what I would say is that, I would say two things. One, if you take your emotional, you know, I was an emotional couch potato. I was an 8 out of 10 and kind of on the physical side, you know, nowhere like The Rock, and an 8 out of 10 in terms of consuming information, knowledge, not reading fiction, And then I was a 2 out of 10 emotionally in terms of that constant unsettledness, envy, still envy, and you know, the inability to be present around loved ones. And so I realized that I just needed to get off the couch, the emotional couch, and the same way that if you just take a 30-minute walk each day, your risk of heart disease will plummet. I was trying to figure out what was the equivalent of taking that walk and really building up that self-knowledge and that emotional self-awareness. And that's where I kind of saw this secret, where, again, this scarcity mindset, zero-sum game Wall Street guy said, well, okay, if you take your 2 to a 4 in emotional self-awareness, then you must take a point or 2 from the other columns. And what I realized as I started to do this self-work was you add to the third column and you also add to the first and the second column. And I was like, I was blown away. I'm like, holy shit, this is incredible. And you actually start to feel better and you unlock creativity and all the beautiful things that you talk about, you know, in your work and on your podcast.
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So maybe you have a creative project that you want to start and you have no idea where to get started or can't figure out even what the first step is. And I always say one of the easiest first steps is to just buy a domain name or to start building a website. It doesn't even have to be a complicated website. It can just be a picture and a bio about you. And fortunately, our friends at HostGator are fantastic for helping you to get started. They have an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy. They have 24/7 live support via phone chat and email. And if you have an existing website that you want to move to HostGator, they make it free and super simple, and they're offering 30% off all of their hosting packages for Unmistakable Creative listeners. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. And if you're looking for a speaker for your event or organization, or you want to bring the Unmistakable Creative team to your event or company for a workshop on creativity and productivity, just visit UnmistakableCreative.com/speaking, fill out the form, and we'll get back to you. So tell me about how this all finally leads to the work that you're doing today and the work that you're, you know, and about the work that you're doing. Because I know that you've been called Oprah for millennials, which is what prompted my interest in your story. And then the other, you know, just doing some research on you, I've seen that you've been an entrepreneur in residence. So I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about both of those things.
Absolutely. So I, when I left finance in May of 2015, We went on a, what I'd say, a family version of Eat, Pray, Love. we took the one-year-old and we got a one-way ticket to Bali and just kind of hung out, went off the grid and just really started to think about what was next, what was important in our lives. Here's the catch. I left finance thinking that I was going to start a venture-backed fintech company. I knew trading systems. I knew data, especially the data sets that finance firms were willing to pay large amounts of money for. And so, you know, I'm holding up horse blinders on my face right now. And they went from being straight ahead to open maybe 15 degrees widened aperture. And so, okay, I'm going to be a fintech entrepreneur. And I've written this in a few blog posts. I wanted to build a company and sell a company for $50 million. Why 50 million? It's like, because if I said like 200, that I'd be so arrogant. And 50 was hard enough to seem like a difficult task, but not something that would make me seem like a total narcissist. which again, it's like the arbitrary nature of that is I laugh just saying that, just realizing that that's how my mind operated.
Sure.
So I get back from this trip and went down the path of maybe starting a venture fund. Didn't really have the confidence. I mean, to leave that and to it's not even knowing what you're going to do, but not have a story for others about what you were going to do. Mm-hmm. Especially in especially coming from immigrant family, especially coming from finance, where there are two states of the world in finance, from a finance person's eyes. You're either working or you're on vacation. That whole part in the middle of experimentation and iterating and all that, that's vacation. And for someone that's used to being known as a high performer, the last thing I wanted to be known as someone that just took an extended vacation, especially when I was trying to figure out what I was going to do next. But fast forward, I finally, because of some of those emotional tools and practices, I was able, I started January of 2016 just writing. And I had never really written before publicly or privately. I mean, I'd done technical writing. And I started writing about how confused I was. and I started writing about this weird thing, how everyone expected that I would know what I was going to do next. I started writing about what it's like to watch your bank account go down every single month, every single day, after you've only seen it move in one direction for 15 years. I started talking about how hard it was for me to be present in my marriage and with my daughter. And I just kind of put it out there. And I put it out on my blog. I had this small newsletter. And it was 5, 10 people reading what I was writing. But I think what was really, there were two things that happened. One was it hit on a few levels. I think one, I was writing from the perspective of a former finance guy that if you looked me up, you're like, oh, okay, this was a serious professional. So there was kind of credibility in that world. The second was people kept coming up to me and saying, thank you. You are writing things that I have thought about my entire life and no one has ever said. I've never read about it, never heard anyone talk about it publicly. And I'll come back to what those some of those things were. And the third thing was, and that's why the newsletter and the blog is called Rad Reads, was like, if we're going to talk about serious topics, like let's pay homage to surf and skate culture and try to use the word rad as often as possible. Like, let's not take ourselves too seriously. And I think I was heavily influenced by the voice of Tim Urban, who takes these really, you know, that post, the tail end about, you know, how many Super Bowls we have left before we die, but takes it and makes it accessible but hard-hitting and relatable. So I was writing in that voice. And then the second thing I was doing was, you know, I didn't know where this was going. To be honest, I still don't exactly know where it's going, but I was experimenting a lot. And I think that one of the things that I did was I started to tell these daily stories on Snapchat. And I had 3 followers on Snapchat. You know, I'm 37, 38 years old. My friends still think that Snapchat is a sexting app. and so they're not on it. And I just started sharing. I'll never forget the first or second story that I shared where I said, don't let anyone define success for you. Success is a very personal journey and only you know what it means. And I just shared what I thought it meant to me at that point in time. And someone wrote back, one of the, I think there maybe were 9 followers at the time. And it was a 20-year-old who was at Tufts. And he just said, I really needed to hear that right now. And I was like, what? Is this happening? I didn't know anyone responded on Snapchat, A, to begin with, and B, that this thing that I was just kind of, you know, emotionally rambling. But it really connected with this one individual. And I just started doing it over and over and over again. I started writing a lot on my blog. I started some experiments that didn't work well. I thought that I could do one crafty kind of Instagram-ish meme with some motivational text on it. I'm just saying it out loud. It's like, of course, that didn't work. But I was delivering it to friends via SMS. And keep in mind, I have no media. At this point, I have no media experience. Like I'm tech forward, but I don't know the tools and I don't know how to use WordPress and things like that. And so I'm just chipping away at it. But I think with the same message, and that goes back to that pie of things that I was writing about. What was I really writing about? I was writing about fear. I was writing about ego and I was writing about mortality. And those are three topics that, you know, especially like grown adult men, they don't really want to talk about that. And I was just, I was going there through, and I think that's really the Oprah for millennials. I'm honored. That's a huge, huge, that is a task. It's an aspirational title that I don't take lightly at all. But I think the one thing that I do take away from that was the public confessional as a form of self-therapy. And that's what I was doing with no real goal in sight. The real marker was I finding joy in what I was writing, and was I able to create meaningful connections with people through my writing and my other experiments. And then in 2016, in the back half of 2016, four incredible things happened. The first were, you alluded to, there were two great pieces of press, the Oprah for Millennials and CNN, and Bloomberg, the Wall Street Guru. And that kind of took me from just this thing amongst friends to a much broader audience. That was the first thing. We can come back to that. The second was I was invited by Quartz to be their entrepreneur in residence. The third was a few of my readers of my newsletter and blog asked me to come in as a coach to their portfolio managers at hedge funds. And so there was the first kind of business model element of my work. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth was I gave a TED talk, a TEDx talk in London. And kind of all those things, they happened so, in hindsight, they happened so quickly. But there was no rhyme or reason. I was just kind of like the cartoon of that chef that has all these pans on, like, in his mouth and flipping stuff and falling all over the place. That's kind of the approach that I was taking, uh-huh. with the two metrics of success being, do I enjoy doing this? And am I connecting with people in doing this? And these four things that happened really kind of took things to the next level, I guess. And so... so that was kind of that's a part of what I'm doing now, and maybe that's a good segue to the second part of the question that you had asked, mm-hmm. Around Quartz.
Yeah.
And so it's been 6 months now that I've been the entrepreneur in residence at Quartz, and Quartz being the digital media company. And I was invited, someone in my social circle, friend, but not a close friend, was just kind of watching afar from kind of what I was doing. I think everyone at the beginning was watching what they thought was going to evolve into a slow moving train wreck. this kind of high achieving finance guy that decides he wants to be a writer and wears his heart on both sleeves in a way that maybe is a little bit uncomfortable to many. But one of the editors was kind of just watching what I was doing, and she asked if I would be interested in kind of taking this inaugural role within at Quartz, where I could really grow these experiments and really learn from the best, whether it's from storytelling or editing or some of the more experimental things that the Quartz is doing with their app or the bots and things like that, or whether it was on the monetization side. And in exchange, I would bring kind of a fresh perspective on media, I guess. I almost cringe calling myself a media person, not because of the industry itself, but I'm like, no, I haven't really done anything yet, guys. I'm still working on this. And so I could bring a different perspective. Quartz is very much into building a community and organizing events. That's something that I could help there. And I could write. And so my writing, I think I've written 12 pieces on Quartz, and it's really... starting to hit a stride, and I've just tremendously improved as a writer.
Wow. You know, I think the one big question that comes from all of that is, you know, you mentioned that the primary metrics by which you measured your success were, you know, am I enjoying this work and is it allowing me to connect with people in a meaningful way? And I'm curious, after you've experienced success, if that has changed at all, and if so, how?
If my personal version of personal definition has evolved?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that I'm constantly, so this is the first thing I do is I constantly write it down. I think that writing these kind of nebulous ideas down it seems like an obvious step, but a lot of people, it just takes effort. And, you know, whether it's values, whether it's, you know, things like, I call it a success statement. I think that people don't invest the time to do it. And so they become less crystal clear as you're doing it or when you're doing it. But I think, so how has it evolved? I think in my definition of personal success, one of the key metrics, I don't even want to call it metrics, it's really kind of states, is am I being the father and husband that I want to be? And there's a financial responsibility of providing, but I think much more in the nuances of am I emotionally present for them? Am I focused when I'm with them? You know, you hear me come back to this focus point a lot, and it's something I struggle with, that with my mind racing at a million miles an hour when I'm, you know, with my 3 years, actually her birthday tomorrow, and really being present and watching her and giving her my all. The second is the ability to do work that connects with others. And I think that when I look back at my finance career, there were clearly traces of that. I loved being a manager, which is not something you often hear finance people say, because managers in finance tend to it's not a function that's held on the highest pedestal. The highest pedestal being, are you a moneymaker? Mm-hmm. And so the ability to impact others and connect with others. The third is what kind of energy do I get from the people around me, and do I give to the people around me? I guess I would tie that into this element of joy. The third or fourth is, am I able to generate an income to sustain these things that I want to do from doing that type of work, right? Whether it's creating different types of creating. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the biggest question right now. There are many steps in the right direction. I've been doing coaching. I've been doing keynotes. I'm in the process of a book proposal, and maybe some atypical ways of funding things like mm-hmm. Patreon and things like that. But that's the part that I haven't fully figured out yet. And then there's other things. One of the reasons why we were in San Diego is the ability. We all want the ability to live by the ocean. and not the East River of Manhattan. And so, you know, there are things part of the reason why I left finance was I wanted to remove myself from the need to have a career in a financial hub, because then you limit yourself to, you know, 10, 15 places in the world. And so the ability to live near an ocean, ideally to surf every day, that's another one. The last, you know what's up.
Yeah.
Another one that's really subtle is being able to express myself creatively, both in my work and in my being. And this is small, but you might see in many of my posts, I talk a lot about sneakers. I love Air Maxes, product of the 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And the whole process, it's my one kind of real material indulgence. The one part of my day that brings me the most joy is which sneakers are going to pair with my outfit. But that's a small win. And I think what I want to, and the last one is the ability to do work from anywhere in the world. That's really important to us as a family, because traveling is so important to us as a family. And so I think the real realization though that I had, Srini, is that there is no step function that gets you there, whether it's the rock's example, or this even scientific studies that show that external motivations do not sustain the way internal motivations sustain for over a long period of time. But the more pragmatic realization that I had is that happiness, but even more just like fulfillment and what I would say inner peace, it's winning by 1,000 small wins as opposed to big step functions. And I think that is the key insight that I kind of discovered. And so winning from 1,000 small wins is that small joy in picking out the Air Maxes. It is in weighing out the coffee ground beans for my AeroPress in the one mug that I use every morning. It is walking my daughter to school, even though it's a 3-minute walk. It is the smoothie. I'm talking about my morning routines. I'm a morning person. It is about kind of the delicious smoothie that Lisa makes every morning that sets the day on the right tone. And so as you start to realize these small wins are everywhere, you just have to see them. You have to believe in them. And that's why I say lead with joy. You know, you have more agency around not spending all time or tons of time around assholes, right? You have more agency than you think. And that is kind of the pearl of wisdom that I feel very fortunate to have discovered.
Wow. I can see now why Christine recommended you as a guest. This has been just absolutely fantastic. So I have one last question, which is how we finish all of our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think that it is a true, I would say it's two things. It's a true belief in themselves, and the ability, which leads to the ability to cut through the noise and not live the stories that others have told you, mm-hmm. That others have told you and others have stated as truths, truisms, paired with a compassionate heart and a genuine love and openness for other people.
Well, I think that makes a really fitting way to wrap up our conversation. Where can people learn more about your work?
I would love for them to check out the RadReads blog, which is radreads.co. Again, the homage to skate and surf culture. You can find RadReads also on Snapchat, and we have a Facebook page, which is also RadReads, and on Twitter, I love to engage and chat around all these topics. My handle is Kemarid. It's my first name, KHEMARIDH.
Awesome. Well, this has been absolutely fantastic. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.